The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Book the Second, Chapter 6, The Broken Jug. After having run for some time at the top of his speed, without knowing whither, knocking his head against many a street corner, leaping many a gutter, traversing many an alley, many a court, many a square, seeking flight and passage through all the meanderings of the ancient passages of the Halys, exploring in his panic terror what the fine Latin of the maps calls totavia, Cheminum et Viaria, our poet suddenly halted for lack of breath in the first place, and in the second, because he had been collared after a fashion by a dilemma which had just occurred to his mind. "It strikes me, Master Pierre Gringoire," he said to himself, placing his finger to his brow, "that you are running like a madman. The little scamps are no less afraid of you than you are of them. It strikes me, I say, that you heard the clatter of their wooden shoes fleeing southward while you were fleeing northward. Now, one of two things, either they have taken flight, and the pallet, which they must have forgotten in their terror, is precisely that hospitable bed in search of which you have been running ever since morning, and which Madame the Virgin miraculously sends you, in order to recompense you for having made a morality in her honour, accompanied by triumphs and mummeries. Or the children have not taken flight, and in that case they have put the brand to the pallet, and that is precisely the good fire which you need to cheer, dry, and warm you. In either case, good fire or good bed, that straw pallet is a gift from heaven. The Blessed Virgin Mary, who stands at the corner of the Rue Maconciel, could only have made Eustache Maubon die for that express purpose, and it is folly on your part to flee thus zigzag like a Picard before a Frenchman, leaving behind you what you seek before you, and you are a fool." Then he retraced his steps, and feeling his way and searching with his nose to the wind and his ears on the alert, he tried to find the blessed pallet again. But in vain. There was nothing to be found but intersections of houses, closed courts, and crossings of streets, in the midst of which he hesitated and doubted incessantly, being more perplexed and entangled in this medley of streets than he would have been even in the labyrinth of the Hôtel des Tournelles. At length he lost patience and exclaimed solemnly, "Cursed be crossroads! 'Tis the devil who has made them in the shape of his pitchfork!" This exclamation afforded him a little solace and a sort of reddish reflection which he caught sight of at that moment at the extremity of a long and narrow lane, completed the elevation of his moral tone. "God be praised," said he. "There it is yonder. There is my pallet burning." And comparing himself to the pilot who suffers shipwreck by night, "Salve!" he added piously. "Salve, Maristella!" Did he address this fragment of litany to the Holy Virgin or to the pallet? We are utterly unable to say. He had taken but a few steps in the long street, which sloped downwards, was unpaved, and more muddy and steep, when he noticed a very singular thing. It was not deserted. Here and there along its extent crawled certain vague and formless masses, all directing their course towards the light which flickered at the end of the street, like those heavy insects which drag along by night from blade to blade of grass towards the shepherd's fire. Nothing renders one so adventurous as not being able to feel the place where one's pocket is situated. Gringoire continued to advance, and had soon joined that one of the forms which dragged along most indolently behind the others. On drawing near, he perceived that it was nothing else than a wretched, legless cripple in a bowl, who was hopping along on his two hands like a wounded field spider which has but two legs left. At the moment when he passed close to this species of spider with a human countenance, it raised towards him a lamentable voice. "La buona mancia, signor, la buona mancia," which means alms. "Deuce take you," said Gringoire, "and me with you, if I know what you mean." And he passed on. He overtook another one of these itinerant masses and examined it. It was an impotent man, both halt and crippled, and halt and crippled to such a degree that the complicated system of crutches and wooden legs which sustained him gave him the air of a mason's scaffolding on the march. Gringoire, who liked noble and classical comparisons, compared him in thought to the living tripod of Vulcan. This living tripod saluted him as he passed, but stopping his hat on a level with Gringoire's chin like a shaving dish, while he shouted in the latter's ears, "Señor Caballero, para comprare un pedazo de pan," which means, "Give me the means to buy a bit of bread, sir." "It appears," said Gringoire, "that this one can also talk, but 'tis a rude language, and he is more fortunate than I if he understands it. then, smiting his brow in a sudden transition of ideas, "By the way, what the deuce did they mean this morning with their Esmeralda?" He was minded to augment his pace, but for the third time something barred his way. This something, or rather someone, was a blind man, a little fellow with a bearded Jewish face, who, rowing away in the space about him, with a stick and towed by a large dog, droned through his nose with a Hungarian accent. "Facitote keretatem." "Well, now," said Gringoire, "here's one at last who speaks a Christian tongue. I must have a very charitable aspect, since they ask alms of me in the present lean condition of my purse. My friend," and he turned towards the blind man, "I sold my last shirt last week, that is to say, since you understand only the language of Cicero, vendidi hebdomade nuper transita miam ultimam chemisan." That said, he turned his back upon the blind man and pursued his way. But the blind man began to increase his stride at the same time, and behold, the cripple and the legless man in his bowl came up on their side in great haste, and with great clamour of bowl and crutches upon the pavement. Then all three, jostling each other at poor Gringoire's heels, began to sing their song to him. "Caritatem," chanted the blind man. "La buena mansilla," chanted the cripple in the bowl. And the lame man took up the musical phrase by repeating, "Un pedazo de pan." Gringoire stopped up his ears. "Oh, Tower of Babel," he exclaimed. He set out to run. The blind man ran. The lame man ran. The cripple in the bowl ran. And then, in proportion as he plunged deeper into the street, cripples in bowls, blind men and lame men swarmed about him, and men with one arm and with one eye, and the leprous with their sores, some emerging from little streets adjacent, some from the air holes of cellars, howling, bellowing, yelping, all limping and halting, all flinging themselves towards the light, and humped up in the mire like snails after a shower. Gringoire, still followed by his three persecutors, and not knowing very well what was to become of him, marched along in terror among them, turning out for the lame. Stepping over the cripples and bowls, with his feet embedded in that anthill of lame men, like the English captain who got caught in the quicksand of a swarm of crabs. The idea occurred to him of making an effort to retrace his steps, but it was too late. This whole legion had closed in behind him, and his three beggars held him fast. So he proceeded, impelled both by this irresistible flood, by fear, and by a vertigo which converted all this into a sort of horrible dream. At last he reached the end of the street. It opened upon an immense place where a thousand scattered lights flickered in the confused mists of night. Gringoire flew thither, hoping to escape by the swiftness of his legs from the three infirm spectres who had clutched him. "On divers hombres!" "Where are you going, my man?" cried the cripple, flinging away his crutches and running after him with the best legs that ever traced a geometrical step upon the pavements of Paris. In the meantime, the legless man, erect upon his feet, crowned Gringoire with his heavy iron bowl, and the blind man glared in his face with flaming eyes. "Where am I?" said the terrified poet. "In the Court of Miracles," replied a fourth spectre who had accosted them. "Upon my soul," resumed Gringoire, "I certainly do behold the blind who see, and the lame who walk, but where is the Savior?" They replied by a burst of sinister laughter. The poor poet cast his eyes about him. It was, in truth, that redoubtable Cour des Miracles, whither an honest man had never penetrated at such an hour, the magic circle where the officers of the Châtelet and the sergeants of the provost ship, who ventured thither, disappeared in morsels, a city of thieves, a hideous wart on the face of Paris, a sewer from which escaped every morning and whither returned every night to crouch, that stream of vices, of mendicancy and vagabondage, who always overflows in the streets of capitals, a monstrous hive to which returned all nightfall with their booty, all the drones of the social order, a lying hospital where the bohemian, the distraught monk, the ruined scholar, the ne'er-do-wells of all nations, Spaniards, Italians, Germans, of all religions, Jews, Christians, Mohammedans, idolaters, covered with painted sores, beggars by day, were transformed by night into brigands, an immense dressing-room, in a word, where, at that epoch, the actors of that eternal comedy, which theft, prostitution, and murder play upon the pavements of Paris, dressed and undressed. It was a vast place, irregular and badly paved, like all the squares of Paris at that date. Fires around which swarmed strange groups blazed here and there. Everyone was going, coming, and shouting. Shrill laughter was to be heard, the wailing of children, the voices of women. The hands and heads of this throng, black against the luminous background, outlined against it 1,000 eccentric gestures. At times upon the ground, where trembled the light of the fires mingled with large, indefinite shadows, one could behold a dog passing which resembled a man who resembled a dog. The limits of races and species seemed effaced in this city as in a pandemonium. Men, women, beasts, age, sex, health, maladies, all seemed to be in common among these people. All went together. They mingled. Confounded. Superposed. Each one there participated in all. The poor and flickering flames of the fire permitted Gringoire to distinguish amid his trouble, all around the immense place, a hideous frame of ancient houses whose worm-eaten, shriveled, stunted facades, each pierced with one or two lighted attic windows, seemed to him in the darkness, like enormous heads of old women ranged in a circle, monstrous and crabbed, winking as they looked on at the witch's Sabbath. It was like a new world, unknown, unheard of, misshapen, creeping, swarming, fantastic. Gringoire, more and more terrified, clutched by the three beggars as by three pairs of tongs, dazed by a throng of other faces which frothed and yelped around him, unhappy Gringoire endeavored to summon his presence of mind in order to recall whether it was a Saturday. But his efforts were in vain. The thread of his memory and of his thought was broken. And, doubting everything, wavering between what he saw and what he felt, he put to himself this unanswerable question. If I exist, does this exist? If this exists, do I exist? At that moment, a distinct cry arose in the buzzing throng which surrounded him. Let's take him to the king! Let's take him to the king! Holy Virgin, murmured Gringoire, the king here must be a ram. To the king! To the king! Repeated all voices. They dragged him off. Each vied with the other in laying his claws upon him. But the three beggars did not lose their hold, and tore him from the rest, howling, He belongs to us! The poet's already sickly doublet yielded its last sigh in this struggle. While traversing the horrible place, his vertigo vanished. After taking a few steps, the sentiment of reality returned to him. He began to become accustomed to the atmosphere of the place. At the first moment there had arisen from his poet's head, or, simply and prosaically, from his empty stomach, a mist, a vapor, so to speak, which, spreading between objects and himself, permitted him to catch a glimpse of them only in the incoherent fog of nightmare, in those shadows of dreams which distort every outline, agglomerating objects into unwieldy groups, dilating things into chimeras, and men into phantoms. Little by little this hallucination was succeeded by a less bewildered and exaggerating view. Reality made its way to the light around him, struck his eyes, struck his feet, and demolished bit by bit all that frightful poetry with which he had at first believed himself to be surrounded. He was forced to perceive that he was not walking in the Styx, but in mud, that he was elbowed not by demons, but by thieves, that it was not his soul which was in question, but his life, since he lacked that precious conciliator which places itself so effectually between the bandit and the honest man, a purse. In short, on examining the orgy more closely and with more coolness, he fell from the witch's Sabbath to the dram shop. The Cour des Miracles was in fact merely a dram shop, but a brigand's dram shop, reddened quite as much with blood as with wine. The spectacle which presented itself to his eyes when his ragged escort finally deposited him at the end of his trip was not fitted to bear him back to poetry, even to the poetry of hell. It was more than ever the prosaic and brutal reality of the tavern. Were we not in the 15th century, we would say that Gringoire had descended from Michelangelo to Callot. Around a great fire which burned on a large circular flagstone, the flames of which had heated red-hot the legs of a tripod, which was empty for the moment, some worm-eaten tables were placed here and there, haphazard, no lackey of a geometrical turn having deigned to adjust their parallelism, or to see to it that they did not make too unusual angles. Upon these tables gleamed several dripping pots of wine and beer, and round these pots were grouped many bacchic visages, purple with the fire and the wine. There was a man with a huge belly and a jovial face, noisily kissing a woman of the town, thick-set and brawny. There was a sort of sham soldier, a naquois, as the slang expression runs, who was whistling as he undid the bandages from his fictitious wound and removing the numbness from his sound and vigorous knee, which had been swathed since morning in 1,000 ligatures. On the other hand, there was a wretched fellow, preparing with celandine and beef's blood his leg of God for the next day. Two tables further on, a palmer, with his pilgrim's costume complete, was practicing the lament of the Holy Queen, not forgetting the drone and the nasal drawl. Further on, a young scamp was taking a lesson in epilepsy from an old pretender who was instructing him in the art of foaming at the mouth by chewing a morsel of soap. Beside him, a man with the dropsy was getting rid of his swelling and making 4 or 5 female thieves who were disputing at the same table over a child who had been stolen that evening hold their noses. All circumstances which, 2 centuries later, seemed so ridiculous to the court, as Saval says, that they served as a pastime to the king and as an introduction to the royal ballet of night, divided into 4 parts and danced on the theater of the Petit Bourbon. Never, adds an eyewitness of 1653, have the sudden metamorphoses of the court of miracles been more happily presented. Benserade prepared us for it by some very gallant verses. Loud laughter everywhere and obscene songs. Each one held his own course, carping and swearing, without listening to his neighbor. Pots clinked and quarrels sprang up at the shock of the pots, and the broken pots made rents in the rags. A big dog, seated on his tail, gazed at the fire. Some children were mingled in this orgy. The stolen child wept and cried. Another, a big boy, 4 years of age, seated with legs dangling upon a bench that was too high for him, before a table that reached to his chin, and uttering not a word. A third, gravely spreading out upon the table with his finger. The melted tallow, which dripped from a candle. Last of all, a little fellow, crouching in the mud, almost lost in a cauldron which he was scraping with a tile, and from which he was evoking a sound that would have made Stradivarius swoon. Near the fire was a hogshead, and on the hogshead a beggar. This was the king on his throne. The three who had Gringoire in their clutches led him in front of the hogshead, and the entire bacchanal rout fell silent for a moment, with the exception of the cauldron inhabited by the child. Gringoire dared neither breathe nor raise his eyes. "Hombre, quita tu sombrero," said one of the three knaves in whose grasp he was, and before he had comprehended the meaning, the other had snatched his hat, a wretched headgear, it is true, but still good on a sunny day or when there was but little rain. Gringoire sighed. Meanwhile, the king addressed him from the summit of his cask.
"Who is this rogue?"
Gringoire shuddered. That voice, although accentuated by menace, recalled to him another voice which, that very morning, had dealt the death blow to his mystery by drawling nasally in the midst of the audience.
"Charity, please!"
He raised his head. It was indeed Clopin Trollfou. Clopin Trollfou, arrayed in his royal insignia, wore neither one rag more nor one rag less. The sore upon his arm had already disappeared. He held in his hand one of those whips made of thongs of white leather, which police sergeants then used to repress the crowd, and which were called bouliers. On his head he wore a sort of headgear bound round and closed at the top. But it was difficult to make out whether it was a child's cap or a king's crown. The two things bore so strong a resemblance to each other. Meanwhile, Gringoire, without knowing why, had regained some hope on recognizing in the king of the Cour des Miracles his accursed mendicant of the Grand Hall.
"Master," stammered he. "Monseigneur, sire, how ought I to address you?" he said at length, having reached the culminating point of his crescendo, and knowing neither how to mount higher nor to descend again.
"Monseigneur, his majesty, or comrade, call me what you please, but make haste. What have you to say in your own defense?"
"In your own defense," thought Gringoire, "that displeases me." He resumed, stuttering, "I am he who this morning—"
"By the devil's claws," interrupted Clopin. "Your name, knave, and nothing more. Listen, you are in the presence of 3 powerful sovereigns.
Myself, Clopin Trollfou, king of Tunes, successor to the Grand Chesre, supreme suzerain of the realm of Argot.
Matthias Hunyadi Spicali, Duke of Egypt and of Bohemia, the old yellow fellow whom you see yonder with a dishclout round his head. Guillaume Rousseau, Emperor of Galilee, that fat fellow who is not listening to us but caressing a wench. We are your judges. You have entered the kingdom of Argot without being an Argotier. You have violated the privileges of our city. You must be punished, unless you are a capon, a Frank Mitu, or a Rethod, that is to say, in the slang of honest folks, a thief, a beggar, or a vagabond. Are you anything of that sort? Justify yourself. Announce your titles.
Alas, said Gringoire, I have not that honour. I am the author.
That is sufficient, resumed Truffaut, without permitting him to finish. You are going to be hanged. 'Tis a very simple matter, gentlemen, an honest bourgeois. As you treat our people in your abode, so we treat you in ours. The law which you apply to vagabonds apply to you. 'Tis your fault if it is harsh. One really must behold the grimace of an honest man above the hempen collar now and then. That renders the thing honourable. Come, friend, divide your rags gaily among these damsels. I am going to have you hanged to amuse the vagabonds, and you are going to give them your purse to drink your health. If you have any mummery to go through with, there's a very good God the Father in that mortar yonder, in stone, which we stole from the Saint-Pierre au Bouff. You have 4 minutes in which to fling your soul at his head. The harangue was formidable.
Well said, upon my soul.
Clopin Truffaut preaches like the holy father of the Pope, exclaimed the Emperor of Galilee, smashing his pot in order to prop up his table.
Messeigneurs, emperors, and kings, said Gringoire coolly, for I know not how firmness had returned to him, and he spoke with resolution.
Don't think of such a thing. My name is Pierre Gringoire. I am the poet whose morality was presented this morning in the Grand Hall of the Courts.
Ah! So it was you, master, said Clopin. I was there, chair to do.
Well, comrade, is that any reason because you bored us to death this morning that you should not be hung this evening?
I shall find difficulty in getting out of it, said Gringoire to himself.
Nevertheless, he made one more effort.
I don't see why poets are not classed with vagabonds, said he.
Vagabond Aesepus certainly was. Homerus was a beggar. Mercurius was a thief.
Clopin interrupted him. I believe that you are trying to blarney us with your jargon. Zounds, let yourself be hung and don't kick up such a row over it.
Pardon me, Monseigneur, the King of Thunes, replied Gringoire, disputing the ground foot by foot. It is worth trouble. One moment, listen to me. You are not going to condemn me without having heard me. His unlucky voice was, in fact, drowned in the uproar which rose around him. The little boy scraped away at his cauldron with more spirit than ever, and, to crown all, an old woman had just placed on the tripod a frying pan of grease which hissed away on the fire with a noise similar to the cry of a troop of children in pursuit of a masquer. In the meantime, Clopin Truffaut appeared to hold a monumentary conference with the Duke of Egypt and the Emperor of Galilee, who was completely drunk. Then he shouted shrilly, "Silence!" And as the cauldron and the frying pan did not heed him and continued their duet, he jumped down from his hogshead, gave a kick to the boiler, which rolled 10 paces away, bearing the child with it, a kick to the frying pan, which upset in the fire, with all its grease, and gravely remounted his throne, without troubling himself about the stifled tears of the child or the grumbling of the old woman, whose supper was wasting away in a white, fine flame. Truffaut made a sign, and the Duke, the Emperor, and the past masters of pickpockets and the isolated robbers came and ranged themselves around him in a horseshoe, of which Gringoire, still roughly held by the body, formed the center. It was a semicircle of rags, tatters, tinsel, pitchforks, axes, legs staggering with intoxication, huge bare arms, faces sordid, dull, and stupid. In the midst of this round table of beggary, Clopin Truffaut, as the doge of this senate, as the king of this peerage, as the pope of this conclave, dominated, first by virtue of the height of his hogshead, and next by virtue of an indescribable, hearty, fierce, and formidable air which caused his eyes to flash and corrected in his savage profile the bestial type of the race of vagabonds. One would have pronounced him a boar amid a herd of swine.
"Listen," said he to Gringoire, fondling his misshapen chin with his horny hand. "I don't see why you should not be hung. It is true that it appears to be repugnant to you, and it is very natural, for you bourgeois are not accustomed to it. You form for yourselves a great idea of the thing. After all, we don't wish you any harm. Here is a means of extricating yourself from your predicament for the moment. Will you become one of us?" The reader can judge of the effect which this proposition produced upon Gringoire, who beheld life slipping away from him, and who was beginning to lose his hold upon it. He clutched at it again with energy. "Certainly I will, and right heartily," said he. "Do you consent," resumed Clopin, "to enroll yourself among the people of the knife?" "Of the knife, precisely," responded Gringoire. "You recognize yourself as a member of the free bourgeoisie?" added the King of the Tunes. "Of the free bourgeoisie. Subject of the Kingdom of Argot?" "Of the Kingdom of Argot." "A vagabond?" "A vagabond. In your soul?" "In my soul." "I must call your attention to the fact," continued the King, "that you will be hung all the same." "The devil," said the poet. "Only," continued Clopin imperturbably, "you will be hung later on, with more ceremony, at the expense of the good city of Paris, on a handsome stone gibbet, and by honest men. That is a consolation." "Just so," responded Gringoire. "There are other advantages. In your quality of a high-toned sharper, you will not have to pay taxes on mud, or the poor, or lanterns to which the bourgeois of Paris are subject." "So be it," said the poet. "I agree. I am a vagabond, a thief, a sharper, a man of the knife, anything you please, and I am all that already, Monsieur King of Thunes, for I am a philosopher. Et omnia in philosophia, omnes in philosopho continentur. All things are contained in philosophy, all men in the philosopher, as you know." The King of Thunes scowled. "What do you take me for, my friend? What Hungarian Jew patter are you jabbering at us? I don't know Hebrew. One isn't a Jew because one is a bandit. I don't even steal any longer. I'm above that. I kill. Cutthroat, yes. Cut purse, no." Gringoire tried to slip in some excuse between these curt words, which wrath rendered more and more jerky. "I ask your pardon, Monseigneur. It is not Hebrew. 'Tis Latin." "I tell you," resumed Clopin angrily, "that I'm not a Jew, and that I'll have you hung, belly of the synagogue, like the little shopkeeper of Judea who is by your side, and whom I entertain strong hopes of seeing nailed to a counter one of these days, like the counterfeit coin that he is." So saying, he pointed his finger at the little bearded Hungarian Jew who had accosted Gringoire with his facetote caritatum, and who, understanding no other language, beheld with surprise the King of Thunes' ill humor overflow upon him. At length, Monsieur Clopin calmed down. "So you will be a vagabond, you knave," he said to our poet. "Of course," replied the poet. "Willing is not all," said the surly Clopin. "Goodwill doesn't put one onion the more into the soup, and 'tis good for nothing except to go to paradise with. Now, paradise and the thieves' band are two different things. In order to be received among the thieves, you must prove that you are good for something, and for that purpose you must search the mannequin." "I'll search anything you like," said Gringoire. Clopin made a sign. Several thieves detached themselves from the circle and returned a moment later. They brought two thick posts, terminated at their lower extremities in spreading timber supports, which made them stand readily upon the ground. To the upper extremity of the two posts they fitted a crossbeam, and the whole constituted a very pretty portable gibbet, which Gringoire had the satisfaction of beholding rise before him in a twinkling. Nothing was lacking, not even the rope which swung gracefully over the crossbeam. "What are they going to do?" Gringoire asked himself with some uneasiness. A sound of bells which he heard at that moment put an end to his anxiety. It was a stuffed mannequin which the vagabonds were suspending by the neck from the rope, a sort of scarecrow dressed in red, and so hung with mule bells and larger bells that one might have tricked out thirsty Castilian mules with them. These thousand tiny bells quivered for some time with the vibration of the rope, then gradually died away and finally became silent, when the mannequin had been brought into a state of immobility by that law of the pendulum which has dethroned the water clock and the hourglass. Then Clopin, putting out to Gringoire a rickety old stool placed beneath the mannequin, "Climb up there."
"Death of the devil," objected Gringoire. "I shall break my neck. Your stool limps like one of Marshall's distiches. It has one hexameter leg and one pentameter leg."
"Climb," repeated Clopin.
Gringoire mounted the stool and succeeded, not without some oscillations of head and arms, in regaining his center of gravity.
"Now," went on the King of Thunes, "twist your right foot round your left leg and rise on the tip of your left foot."
"Monseigneur," said Gringoire, "so you absolutely insist on my breaking some one of my limbs?"
Clopin tossed his head.
"Harkee, my friend, you talk too much. Here's the gist of the matter in two words. You are to rise on tiptoe, as I tell you. In that way, you will be able to reach the pocket of the mannequin. You will rummage it. You will pull out the purse that is there. And if you do all this without our hearing the sound of a bell, all is well. You shall be a vagabond. All we shall then have to do will be to thrash you soundly for the space of a week."
"Ventre Dieu!"
"I will be careful," said Gringoire. "And suppose I do make the bells sound?"
"Then you will be hanged. Do you understand?"
"I don't understand at all," replied Gringoire. "Listen once more. You are to search the mannequin and take away its purse. If a single bell stirs during the operation, you will be hung. Do you understand that?"
"Good," said Gringoire. "I understand that. And then,
if you succeed in removing the purse without our hearing the bells, you are a vagabond, and you will be thrashed for 8 consecutive days. You understand now, no doubt."
"No, Monseigneur. I no longer understand. Where is the advantage to me, hanged in one case, cudgeled in the other?"
"And a vagabond," resumed Clopin, "and a vagabond, is that for nothing? It is for your interest that we should beat you in order to harden you to blows."
"Many thanks," replied the poet.
"Come, make haste," said the king, stamping upon his cask, which resounded like a huge drum.
"Search the mannequin, and let there be an end to this. I warn you for the last time that if I hear a single bell, you will take the place of the mannequin."
The band of thieves applauded Clopin's words and arranged themselves in a circle around the gibbet with a laugh so pitiless that Gringoire perceived that he amused them too much not to have everything to fear from them. No hope was left for him, accordingly, unless it were the slight chance of succeeding in the formidable operation which was imposed upon him. He decided to risk it, but it was not without first having addressed a fervent prayer to the mannequin he was about to plunder, and who would have been easier to move to pity than the vagabonds. These myriad bells with their little copper tongues seemed to him like the mouth of so many asps, open and ready to sting and to hiss.
"Oh," he said in a very low voice, "is it possible that my life depends on the slightest vibration of the least of these bells? Oh," he added with clasped hands, "bells, do not ring. Hand bells, do not clang. Mule bells, do not quiver."
He made one more attempt upon Trelfou.
"And if there should come a gust of wind?"
"You will be hanged," replied the other without hesitation.
Perceiving that no respite, nor reprieve, nor subterfuge was possible, he bravely decided upon his course of action. He wound his right foot round his left leg, raised himself on his left foot, and stretched out his arm. But at the moment when his hand touched the mannequin, his body, which was now supported upon one leg only, wavered on the stool, which had but 3. He made an involuntary effort to support himself by the mannequin, lost his balance, and fell heavily to the ground, deafened by the fatal vibration of the 1,000 bells of the mannequin, which, yielding to the impulse imparted by his hand, described first a rotary motion, and then swayed majestically between the 2 posts.
"Malediction!" he cried as he fell, and remained as though dead with his face to the earth.
Meanwhile, he heard the dreadful peal above his head, the diabolical laughter of the vagabonds, and the voice of Trelfou saying, "Pick up that young knave and hang him without ceremony." He rose. They had already detached the mannequin to make room for him. The thieves made him mount the stool. Clopin came to him, passed the rope about his neck, and tapping him on the shoulder,
"Adieu, my friend. You can't escape now, even if you digested with the Pope's guts."
The word mercy died away upon Gringoire's lips. He cast his eyes about him, but there was no hope. All were laughing.
"Bervigne de l'Etule," said the King of Thunes to an enormous vagabond who stepped out from the ranks. "Climb upon the crossbeam."
Bervigne de l'Etule nimbly mounted the transverse beam, and in another minute, Gringoire, on raising his eyes, beheld him with terror seated upon the beam above his head.
"Now," resumed Clopin Trilfou, "as soon as I clap my hands, you, André the Red, will fling the stool to the ground with a blow of your knee. You, François Chanteprunet, will cling to the feet of the rascal, and you, Bervigne, will fling yourself on his shoulders, and all three at once, do you hear?"
Gringoire shuddered.
"Are you ready?" said Clopin Trilfou to the three thieves, who held themselves in readiness to fall upon Gringoire. A moment of horrible suspense ensued for the poor victim, during which Clopin tranquilly thrust into the fire with the tip of his foot some bits of vine shoots which the flame had not caught.
"Are you ready?" he repeated, and opened his hands to clap. 1 second more, and all would have been over. But he paused as though struck by a sudden thought.
"One moment," said he. "I forgot. It is our custom not to hang a man without inquiring whether there is any woman who wants him. Comrade, this is your last resource. You must wed either a female vagabond or the noose."
The law of the vagabonds, singular as it may strike the reader, remains today written out at length in ancient English legislation. You may see this in Burrington's Observations. Gringoire breathed again. This was the second time that he had returned to life within an hour, so he did not dare to trust to it too implicitly.
"Hola!" cried Clopin, mounted once more upon his hask. "Hola, females, women! Is there among you from the sorceress who wants this rascal? Hola, Colette Lacheron, Elizabeth Trevin, Simone Jordion, Marie Perbeau, Thon et Lelong, Barat de Fanul, Michel Guénal, Claudron Jollet, Mathieu Ringerot, hola! Isabelle Lathier, come and see, a man for nothing. Who wants him?"
Gringoire, no doubt, was not very appetizing in this miserable condition. The female vagabonds did not seem to be much affected by the proposition. The unhappy wretch heard them answer,
"Now, now, hang him. There'll be the more fun for us all."
Nevertheless, three emerged from the throng and came to smell of him. The first was a big wench with a square face. She examined the philosopher's deplorable doublet attentively. His garment was worn and more full of holes than a stove for roasting chestnuts. The girl made a wry face.
"Old rag," she muttered, and, addressing Gringoire, "let's see your cloak."
"I have lost it," replied Gringoire.
"Your hat?" "They took it away from me." "Your shoes?" "They have hardly any soles left." "Your purse?" "Alas," stammered Gringoire, "I have not even a sou."
"Let them hang you, then, and say thank you," retorted the vagabond wench, turning her back on him. The second, old, black, wrinkled, hideous, with an ugliness conspicuous even in the Cour de Mericales, trotted round Gringoire. He almost trembled lest she should want him, but she mumbled between her teeth,
"He's too thin," and went off.
The third was a young girl, quite fresh and not too ugly.
"Save me," said the poor fellow to her in a low tone.
She gazed at him for a moment with an air of pity, then dropped her eyes, made a plait in her petticoat, and remained in indecision. He followed all these movements with his eyes. It was the last gleam of hope.
"No," said the young girl at length, "no. Guillaume Longjou would beat me."
She retreated into the crowd.
"You are unlucky, comrade," said Clopin.
Then, rising to his feet upon his hogshead,
"No one wants him," he exclaimed, imitating the accent of an auctioneer to the great delight of all. "No one wants him. Once, twice, three times," and turning towards the gibbet with the sign of his hand, "gone."
Bervigne de l'Etoile, André the Red, François Chanteprunet stepped up to Gringoire. At that moment, a cry arose among the thieves.
"La Esmeralda! La Esmeralda!"
Gringoire shuddered and turned towards the side whence the clamour proceeded. The crowd opened and gave passage to a pure and dazzling form. It was the gypsy. "La Esmeralda," said Gringoire, stupefied in the midst of his emotions by the abrupt manner in which that magic word knotted together all his reminiscences of the day. This rare creature seemed, even in the Corps de Meraclaus, to exercise her sway of charm and beauty. The vagabonds, male and female, ranged themselves gently along her path, and their brutal faces beamed beneath her glance. She approached the victim with her light step. Her pretty Djali followed her. Gringoire was more dead than alive. She examined him for a moment in silence. "You are going to hang this man?" she said gravely to Clopin. "Yes, sister," replied the King of Thunes, "unless you will take him for your husband." She made her pretty little pout with her underlip. "I'll take him," said she. Gringoire firmly believed that he had been in a dream ever since morning, and that this was the continuation of it. The change was, in fact, violent, though a gratifying one. They undid the noose and made the poet step down from the stool. His emotion was so lively that he was obliged to sit down. The Duke of Egypt brought an earthenware crock without uttering a word. The gypsy offered it to Gringoire. "Fling it on the ground," said she. The crock broke into four pieces. "Brother," then said the Duke of Egypt, laying his hands upon their foreheads, "she is your wife." "Sister, he is your husband for 4 years. Go." The end of Book the Second, Chapter 6 of The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.